Volunteers at CJSF wish you a fun-filled Hanukkah and Happy New Year.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I am joined today by Aaron Wang and Michael Robert Kaditz. We're starting a new series today. This is episode one of a series that I'll be doing on the Pre-Socratics. I've been wanting to get around to read the Pre-Socratics for a while. I think they make a good school of philosophy for kind of going through casually and just reading through. And I thought it would be interesting to come onto the show with others and have a discussion about them. I'm mostly interested in having discussions about these, kind of sitting around almost casually discussing them. I think when we get into the later philosophers, that'll be quite interesting. But since we're starting with the Milesians, if anyone has read the Milesians before, they're a little, I don't want to say dry, but they can be difficult to discuss. But since we are beginning a series on these, this isn't just us reading them in isolation, I think it's important to go into a bit of not just the subject of the Milesians, who are the first philosophers we'll be reading, but the Pre-Socratics in general. And if you're going to be talking about the Pre-Socratics in general, the thing that always comes up is this notion of a mythos or muthos and logos, this movement from a previous era in which when people inquired into things, they inquired into the muthos. But now we're moving into an era where people use logos to discuss things. Now, those are Greek terms. What do they mean? I was reading the Poetics by Aristotle a bit ago, and Aristotle uses the word muthos to describe, so he has a section on tragedy, and he's analyzing tragedy. And the word that he uses to call the plot of a tragedy, he calls that the muthos in Greek. Now, a muthos isn't just a plot in a play, but when you think about myths and mythology, and that's where we get our word mythology, mythologies are stories, they're tales, they're narratives, and they're not just stories, they're stories with events. They have characters in them, and those characters have personalities. In the times before the philosophers came about in Greece, there was a writer named Hesiod, and he wrote two works, the Theogony and the Works and Days, but the Theogony was specifically the work that he used a kind of muthos approach to inquiring about the world. He was trying to figure out, what are the gods and where do they come from? Who do they come from? What are the events concerning the gods and whatnot? Now, the gods weren't just Zeus, Aphrodite, Hera, and whatnot, but they were all kinds of different abstractions. So this was a method of inquiry. If you wanted to know what night was, or what sleep was, you would inquire into their relationship with each other and certain events that lead to those relationships. Now, we can read Hesiod's Theogony, but we're philosophers, so we should probably turn to an example in the philosophical literature. And if we have read Plato's Symposium, we actually have a muthos in Plato's Symposium. When Socrates asks Diotima, what is love? He asks, who are his father and mother? And I'm reading from the Symposium now. Diotima actually gives us a muthos in a philosophical work. I think this is worth reading from just because it's a good example of getting on the table what a muthos actually looks like. So I'll read this. So Socrates asks, who are love's father and mother? And Diotima says, that's a rather long story, she said. I'll tell it to you all the same. It's not that long. When Aphrodite was born, the gods held a celebration. Poros, the son of Metis, was there among them. When they had feasted, Paneia came begging as poverty does when there's a party, and stayed by the gates. Now, Poros got drunk on nectar, and there was no wine yet, you see, and feeling drowsy, went into the garden of Zeus, where he fell asleep. Then Paneia schemed up a plan to relieve her lack of resources. She would get a child from Poros. So she lay beside him and got pregnant with love. That is why love was born to follow Aphrodite and serve her, because he was conceived on the day of her birth. And that's why he is also by nature a lover of beauty, because Aphrodite herself is especially beautiful. So it's interesting. You have a story that tells you the conception of a concept, love. And these are certain events. The gods do things, and something comes about. Now, the mythos continues to actually give us a bit of the character of love as well. So it's not just a causal thing. It's actually also descriptive. As the son of Poros and Panea, his lot in life is set to be like theirs. In the first place, he is always poor, and he's far from being delicate and beautiful as ordinary people think he is. Instead, he is tough and shriveled and shoeless and homeless, always lying on the dirt without a bed, sleeping at people's doorsteps and in roadsides under the sky, having his mother's nature, always living with need. But on his father's side, he is a schemer after the beautiful and the good. He is brave, impetuous, and intense, an awesome hunter, always weaving snares, resourceful in his pursuit of intelligence, a lover of wisdom through all his life, a genius with enchantments, potions, and clever pleadings. So I'm putting this on the table to say that this is going to be our example of a mythos, and as we move into a logos, we'll learn in what way this contrasts with a mythos. Now, how does the actual transition from using tales and narratives like this to what will ultimately become kind of scientific explanations? That's what a logos is tend to, that's what it's usually conceived of as a kind of scientific or rational explanation. We'll have a bit to say about that in a bit. But the movement from that is the movement into philosophy, or the appearance of philosophy in the Greek world. Now, philosophy begins with the Milesians. That's the kind of traditional story. I've always been, well, I don't want to say I've been skeptical of that, as if it emerged somewhere else, but I've always wondered how it is that the Milesians were the ones who kind of spawned philosophy almost out of nothing. And some scholars have said that with Thales being the first philosopher, it just happened. There was a stroke of genius. This is what Burnett says in his texts. He says that there's certainly influence, but it can be more or less ascribed to the genius of Thales. Now, I'm a bit skeptical of things like genius and whatnot. So I read mostly Edward Husey's text, and I read a little bit of Guthrie as well. And on my reading, it comes down to two things. So the two factors of the emergence of philosophy in Miletus seem to be, the first is historical circumstance, and the second is a kind of cultural influence, so pulling in things from other cultures. The historical circumstance kind of enables the cultural influence to become what it is, so I'll explain what that means. At the time that So a couple hundred years before Miletus had Thales, and Thales begun doing natural philosophy, there were some political changes on the coast. So Miletus is in what is now Western Turkey, and this region of Greece at the time was called Ionia, which is why the Milesians are sometimes called the Ionians. There's other Ionians too, but in any case, around this time, and this is about 800 to 700 BC, we have a change in the political circumstances. So initially you have kings who have royal courts and they collect resources. But what happens is a new kind of warfare initiates. So we get the emergence of hoplite warfare, which means that people and subjects are becoming quite wealthy. They have to be able to afford this armor, and it's happening especially in the Ionian coast because of mercantilism as an economic system, but there's a lot of trade going on. Citizens are becoming a bit more wealthy, and they're having to be put into these hoplite positions. And at this point, you have the emergence of tyrants. Now, tyrants in this time are not, there's no real negative connotation to them yet. Eventually there will be, and given a couple hundred years. But at this point, a tyrant is just someone who has the backing of the relatively wealthy citizenry. They can perform a coup d'etat on the kings, redistribute the wealth, and the people, and this is the significant thing, this is the political ramification, the people who back the tyrant get political sway. And if everyone does that, then you have a kind of forced political equality within the communities. So you have the emergence of essentially, you have kings, but you have politically equal people in communities because they backed a king. So that is the political circumstance. One of the other historical circumstances of this is the innovation of the Phoenician alphabet. So the Phoenician alphabet lets people learn to write a lot easier because you're working with the Phoenician alphabet, ABCs, phonetically rendered symbols. They're much easier to learn and people can learn them. They're not reserved for a priestly class like it is in Egypt where you have to learn hieroglyphic and whatnot. So you have politically equal people who can all read the laws that are being written. And so you have, this means that everyone who is discussing law has basically equal standing when they are debating law. They have to appeal to each other and appeal to each sense of what is right or wrong. So you have, especially in Miletus, you have this feeling of citizenry and that people can discuss things with each other. Everything's kind of on the table. I mean, again, there are still kings, but these kings are giving people their favor because they enable them to get into power. So that is the political circumstance. And this is really important. Husey makes a very big deal out of this. The other is the cultural influence. There's a lot of different cultures going on at the time. Not all of them have the same influence in Miletus at this point. So for example, the Egyptians are going to influence the Pythagoreans and Plato, and the Scythians as well in the north have shamanistic and animistic beliefs. But specifically, it is in the Near East of Babylon that is going to influence Miletus and the Milesians, because Miletus has math. They have mathematics and they have astronomy and they have records of astronomical events and whatnot. And this is important because in Babylon at this time, their math has kind of stagnated, but since a lot of trading is going on in Miletus, mathematics and astronomy and even their mythology is coming in, and it's coming into people who are open to discussing this stuff. They are on political equal grounds. They're not, you know, discussing mathematics back and forth in the court, but this political circumstance enables an intellectual climate of discussing things and exploring things conceptually. So this is where the beginnings of a logos are coming about. It's almost the perfect storm, right? You have a lot of mathematical knowledge being trafficked into Miletus. Miletus, I should say, also is quite well off for what they've been doing. We know this because they had many colonies and they could afford to support these colonies and whatnot. And this doesn't causally lead to Thales, but I think Husey is onto something in that you have the plausible conditions for intellectual activity, for what Aristotle said you needed for philosophy, leisure, skole. It's where we get the word school from. So these are the sort of historical circumstances that lead to the right conditions for other cultural influences to come into Miletus and have their effect, to have philosophy come about. So on my reading of, well, did the Greeks really come up with philosophy or not? My approach is to say that it's much more complicated than whether the Greeks came up with philosophy or not. Philosophy appears to begin in Greece, but it is because Miletus at this time is a kind of perfect storm for other cultural ideas to come in and be invigorated by something like the political institutions that are emerging out of the Ionian coast. And I mean, these are happening all over the place. Everywhere there are tyrants, but Miletus is especially suited for this. It is a trade hub and it is very well off, and in this city, you have Thales. Thales begins to discuss, well, this is the frustrating thing. We don't know a lot about what Thales did or said, but this brings me to the sources that we have for the pre-Socratics. So bringing this back to the pre-Socratics themselves, this has been a lot of talk about history and whatnot. Nothing that we have of the pre-Socratics survives in full. And in some cases, we don't even have anything. Thales is one of those cases. We only know that he said basically two philosophically relevant things. One of them, it has to do with what he called the arche, or what this is a thing. This is what the doxographers, or the people who tried to preserve their opinions, called the arche, or the principle, the first principles of reality or of the universe. And Thales said that the arche, first principle, is water. Essentially, this means that all things are water, that water governs the universe. Now, that's pretty, I don't know how water governs absolutely everything, but for a form of explanation for the universe, as opposed to a story about how the universe came about, it can be a plausible story or a plausible explanation. Aristotle, in particular, cites that the plausibility of this comes about from the fact that everything living needs water. Every life source needs water. I am reading from the First Philosophers, Pre-Socratics and the Sophists, or a translation of it by Robin Waterfield in the Oxford World Classics series. Most of the original seekers after knowledge recognized only first principles of the material kind as the first principles of all things. For that out of which all existing things are formed, from which they originally come into existence, and into which they are finally destroyed, whose substance persists while changing its qualities, this, they say, is the element and first principle of all things. However, they disagree about how many of such first principles there are and about what they are like. Thales, who was the founder of this kind of philosophy, says that water is the first principle, which is why he declared that the earth was on water. He perhaps reached this conclusion from seeing that everything's food is moist, and that moisture is the source and prerequisite for the life of warmth itself, and the source of anything is the first principle of that thing. So, as I say, it was perhaps this that led him to reach this conclusion, and also the fact that the seeds of all things have a moist nature, and water is the first principle of the moist nature of moist things. That's just an Aristotelianism. And there are people who think that those in the dim, distant past who first began to reason about the gods long before our present generation shared this conception of the underlying nature. For these poets made ocean and Tethys the parents of creation, and claimed that the gods took their oath upon water, the river Styx, as the poets called it. So Aristotle is saying, even in the mythos explanation of the way that the world's come to be, they refer to water as the first principle of anything. So it makes complete sense that Thales, when referring to a natural explanation of what the first principle of the universe is and what governs it, it would be water. Everything seems to need water, and the earth itself also appears to rest on water.
Let me just read a short paragraph from the United States Geological Survey. You might wonder why I'm bringing that into a discussion on pre-Socrates philosophy, but I'm going to underline your point.
Sure, yeah.
That I think what you're saying is that we can see the roots of modern scientific thinking, even in pre-Socratic philosophy. So here's the paragraph, here's the quote. Water is called the universal solvent because it is capable of dissolving more substances than any other liquid. This is important to every living thing on Earth. It means that wherever water goes, either through the air, the ground, or through our bodies, it takes along valuable chemicals, minerals, and nutrients. That's a scientific statement, and that sounds a lot like what you're saying was the rational basis for the pre-Socratics to use water, hold out water as underlying everything.
Yeah.
It sounds very scientific.
Yeah, it does sound scientific. It's an attempt to rationally explain at least as much as possible. I mean, it's not just that, I like that term, the universal solvent, everything needs water. Thales also appeals to water to explain natural phenomenon like earthquake. So I'm reading at T10. Thales says that the world is held up by water and rides on it like a ship, and that what we call an earthquake happens when the earth rocks because of the movement of the water. Now that's interesting.
It's almost correct. Almost.
Almost.
In fact, the continents float on the water. That's true. We know that to be geologically true today. And we know that earthquakes are caused by the movement of the tectonic plates, which move around on the surface of the earth. So that was pretty close.
The other thing, too, about this is that there is a move that is being made, and we can exemplify, again, the move from a sort of muthos structure to a logos explanation. And it's that before, what would have explained this earthquake is Poseidon, right? What's interesting about this is that I want to notice the level of generality that is being moved to in this fragment, where Thales is almost correct about the cause of earthquakes. What he's doing is he's explaining the cause of earthquakes in general. So in general, if an earthquake happens, it's because of the movement of water. Now, when you are looking for an explanation of an earthquake through a muthos and you appeal to the will of Poseidon, it's not just that Poseidon has caused the earthquake, right? Because an earthquake can happen and someone can say, why'd that happen? And you could have someone say, well, Poseidon caused it. But in a world where Poseidon causes earthquakes, they would just say, well, yeah, I knew that. But why did Poseidon do it? Like, why this particular earthquake, right? And for that, you need a priest of Poseidon, and you need to go and appeal to a prophet or a priest or priestess who knows the will of Poseidon. So you move away from seeking the explanation of particular events like this that you learn about through a kind of asymmetrical relationship with a religious person who can discern the will of Poseidon, to a very general explanation of, well, all earthquakes are caused by the same thing. It wasn't that Poseidon got upset with this particular god on this day, or this happened, you know, Poseidon got upset, you know, about something else. It's just that all of these things have an organized structure. They all get caused by the same phenomenon. And so we can explain these things in general. And also notice the leveling of the asymmetry. You no longer need to appeal to the will of Poseidon that is discerned through a priest or priestess. Anyone can discern this. It is general. Anyone who has a rational capacity who has logos can discern this. And I think this is kind of one of the reasons I like Husey's sort of historical circumstances as explaining this, is because you wouldn't have had this if people weren't discussing things together. It shares the rationality throughout the community, whereas before you would have had different classes who had kind of privileged knowledge about the will of Poseidon versus the initiates who need to pay homage and usually in money.
What impressed me in my research, Brandon, was how it struck me that the mixture, the sort of two parallel tracks in pre-Socratic times, the track of religion on one hand and naturalistic explanations, sort of the precursor to modern science on the other, they coexisted at that time.
Yeah.
My research indicates that those pre-Socratic philosophers were not atheists for the most part. They believed in the gods.
Yeah.
In the Athenian gods, the Greek gods. But they entertained naturalistic explanations at the same time. And that's very much the mix that we have in Western society today, I believe.
I believe
we have both religion and naturalistic explanations. Now, different segments of society might entertain those two tracks in different proportions. I mean, you have extremes on either side. You have those that attribute everything to God, and you have on the other extreme those that are atheists. You have atheist scientists that think everything is a naturalistic explanation. But I think a large number of people today are somewhere in between, and sometimes it's thought of as contradictory. But, you know, even like Albert Einstein, the great scientist, was known to have faith, religious faith, and yet look at his scientific discoveries. So so that's what struck me, was the similarity in the mixture between religion and at least the beginnings of rational thought and scientific thought back in the pre-Socratic times.
Yeah, that is interesting to note. That was, so that's another interesting thing to kind of get into about this is what the theological, I guess, implications of this would be, because in calling the, in calling water the arche, in calling it the first principle, Thales is seeing it as divine, and the other two Milesians see their arche, see their explanation for the cosmos as divine. And one of the interesting things about that is that actually they are making an important step in theological reasoning, because they discern the fact that, and this is explicit, it's not explicitly mentioned by Anaximander, but in the concept of the unbounded or the boundless of Anaximander, we see this really for the first time. And it's this idea that not only the gods are supposed to be immortal, that's nothing new, but for Anaximander, and maybe this is a good way of transitioning into Anaximander, not only is the Arche immortal in that it is forever in the future, but it has always been. It is ungenerated, right? It is not, it was never born. It just always has existed. Whereas in the old conception of the gods, they're defined by being born. That's what a theogony is. A genealogy is the tree of a god, of the gods being born. You learn what a god, you learn who a god is by the circumstances that they were born into. Not so anymore with Anaximander and his divine unbounded first principle. It always was and always will be. It is birthless and deathless. And that is an enormous step for the Greeks to take in their religious thinking. So they did think of the first arche as divine, but not only that, by doing so, they make a kind of theological, I guess, step, as it were.
Something else occurred to me also when you were giving a history earlier, Brandon, which is, I'm not sure you said this explicitly, but I believe that one of the important factors that encouraged the development of the pre-Socratic thinking, to the extent that it was at the time very almost radical in some ways, moving from stories about the gods' desires and wrath and anger as being the cause of natural events to a more naturalistic explanation, leading to science, you know. But I think one of the major factors that was in place was the democratic nature, was the Athenian democracy, freedom of expression compared to the way the world had been and still was in other parts of the world, the freedom of expression that what Plato criticized as being an embroidery of many colors, to the extent that Athenian civilization had evolved into that type of embroidery of many colors. Those many colors included these new ideas that were being developed. And then the increased geographical movement, the trade between different parts of not just Athens proper, but the whole continent.
We're not in Athens yet. We're still on the Ionian coast, right?
Okay. Right.
So Miletus is on the Ionian coast, and you're right to, but I want to contain what you're saying, because maybe, okay, it's not in Athens, it's in Miletus, but it's a kind of democratic.
But the Athenian context will come out of this Ionian tradition eventually.
Well, yes, because what's happening is the Age of the Tyrants is happening everywhere. All kinds of citizenries are emerging, and they're being backed, or all kinds of tyrants are emerging, being backed by well-to-do citizenry who are enabled to be well-to-do by their contributions to the political community through the emerging hoplite warfare.
And also because they have access to trade ships, so these wealthy people can move between cities.
Yeah, Athens has the Piraeus, yeah.
We can kind of see Athens as being like it's a crude analogy, but like a second Miletus, or a more grandiose version of it. Although
it will become intellectual. So it will become intellectually significant in about 100 years. But the main players of the pre-Socratics are actually the Ionian coast. So there is Miletus. There will also be Ephesus. There will be Clemenzoe. I think that's how it's pronounced. But what's significant too is there will be colonies on the Italian peninsula, which will be called Magna Graeca. Two specifically are really important. So we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but that's okay. Croton is where Pythagorean is.